From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very thankful for that support. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, October 25th is Reformation Sunday for Protestant Christians. Sundown next Friday brings the start of the Wicca and pagan observance of Samhain and Beltane. And although for most Halloween is a secular celebration of candy and costumes, October 31st is originally the Christian feast of All Hallows' Eve, the night before All Saints' Day. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
The first parliament of the world's religions was held in Chicago in 1893. They believed that if they couldn't find a way to have peace and harmony between religions, then how could we expect to have peace and harmony between nations?
Last weekend, 10,000 representatives of 50 faith traditions traveled from 80 countries to gather in Salt Lake City, Utah for the meeting of the Parliament of the World's Religions. Even as religion seems caught in the middle of some of the world's worst conflicts, this was an opportunity to pursue the possibilities for working together for the good. Reverend Mark Lukens, board chair of Interfaith Alliance of Long Island, New York, was there, and on this week's show, we'll hear his firsthand impressions.
So many speeches end like this.
God bless America.
God bless America.
God bless America.
But with surveys showing one-third of adults under 30 don't identify with any religion, God's place of prominence in American politics may no longer be as assured. Jerome Sokolowski, VOA News, Washington.
All too often these days, we see religion hijacked to serve an agenda, whether political, social, or even military. And it's more important than ever to have objective sources of unbiased information. Religion News Service is a crucial resource for this, and a brand new editor-in-chief has just been appointed. He's veteran religion journalist and broadcaster Jerome Sokolowski, and he'll be with us on this week's State of Belief. But first,
Dmitry Shishovsky is a Russian LGBT activist. He was attacked and shot in the eye with an air gun in his home country for simply speaking out.
WCAF may hide behind their positive rhetoric, but the damage they have done to my country, to my community, and to me cannot be hidden.
One more so-called pro-family entity that has its slimy roots in the United States, but has been doing most of its destructive work overseas, is the carefully named World Congress of Families. But this weekend, WCF is bringing the hate home with a global gathering in, yep, you guessed it, Salt Lake City. Joining me now is Eric Ethington of Political Research Associates, a nonprofit that does great work in exposing the ways in which the religious right regularly undermines civil society and human rights. Eric, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much for having me.
Why is this group of particular concern, so much so that the Southern Poverty Law Center labels them as a hate group?
Well, the World Congress of Families acts as a networking group. You know, when there are these U.S. conservative groups who wish to go into foreign countries and start creating anti-LGBTQ or anti-reproductive health laws, very often it's the World Congress of Families who steps in and will hold a local conference and connect these U.S. groups with foreign political officials or religious officials or cultural leaders to create the foundations for those types of anti-human rights laws to come to be.
Eric, why have they focused so much on stirring up hate in foreign countries and not doing such a thing here?
You know, there's one group in particular who laid it out very well for themselves and that's Alliance Defending Freedom, which is a very close partner of the World Congress of Families, when they said that increasingly U.S. judges and courts are looking to foreign courts and international courts when they issue their rulings. So because the U.S. right has of late been very unsuccessful in their court challenges to pro-human rights laws, they're doing their best to go abroad and create laws and court rulings that favor them, which they hope they can then re-import back to the United States.
Hmm. Is it too simple to say that this is a religious right group that is just devoted to working overseas?
I don't think that's unfair at all. The World Congress of Families, up until this year, has exclusively worked overseas. This is the very first time they have held their international conference on U.S. soil, even though they're based in Rockford, Illinois. And our belief is that it is because there has been increased attention and focus placed on them and their member organizations in the U.S. press, thanks to groups like PRA, SPLC, and others. So their hope is that they can come into the U.S., get in front of U.S. press, and attempt to moderate their language, tone down their rhetoric, and disavow or hide what they are doing overseas so that they can appear like any other friendly, cuddly, warm, and fuzzy pro-family group, mm-hmm. so that they can then go back to their work overseas without the U.S. press paying attention to what they're doing.
What are some of the major countries that they focused on in doing their work?
There has been a lot of work done in Russia, Ukraine, Slovakia, Eastern Europe, and then, of course, quite a few countries in Africa. But then you also have groups like Alliance Defending Freedom, which have placed a heavily renewed focus on Latin America recently. In fact, we just released a report a few months ago showing how Alliance Defending Freedom gained special access to the OAS, the Organization of American States, and successfully lobbied to block a treaty which could have done quite a bit to decrease the level of violence against LGBTQ people in Latin American countries.
Eric, is the purpose of these groups large enough to do some work that really would help strengthen families and protect families overseas, or is most of this work aimed at attacking LGBT people and what they're dealing with?
You know, their work is specifically around attacking LGBTQ people as well as reproductive health. Mm-hmm. Part of the release that we just put out on politicalresearch.org, we try to decode some of the language that they use, specifically when they start talking about the natural family or religious freedom. You know, when they say the natural family, they're talking about a very small, very narrow definition of what it means to be a family. Mm-hmm. They do not include, single parents or children being raised by grandparents, certainly not same-sex parents. Mm-hmm. They, in fact, are doing a lot more than just anti-LGBTQ work. If they're policies were fully implemented everywhere, you would see a lot of struggle for families across the board.
How has the WCF harmed LGBTQ people overseas?
Well, let me give a couple examples. As we know, WCF has been very active in Russia, helping to connect U.S. groups to particularly politicians and MPs in that country. Following their work, their very dedicated work to that, we saw laws spring into place like their anti-gay propaganda law that Russia passed. Mm-hmm. Also in Nigeria, they held their conference in Nigeria in Africa, and following their conference and the work of their member organizations, you then saw laws pop up there further criminalizing LGBTQ people. And in each of these instances, as we see WCF and these groups working in these countries, human rights watchdogs like Amnesty International have tracked a marked increase in violence against LGBTQ people. Mm-hmm. You know, this isn't just about what the laws do, although the laws are certainly dreadful on their own. But when you start getting some of these foreign countries to pass those laws limiting the human rights of LGBTQ people, mm-hmm. you instantly see violence and targeting of sexual minorities in these countries. And that is should be a huge concern for everybody, because it's coming from our own neighbors next door.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I know these people have held several of their meetings outside of the United States. Is there any significance to the fact that they are meeting this time in the United States?
In some ways. We think it has more to do with their positioning of themselves in the press, trying to take some of the heat off of themselves that has been building over the last couple of years. I don't think that it was by any means a mistake that not only are they coming to the United States, but they're also coming to Salt Lake City, Utah, specifically, because that is very friendly turf for them. It's an extraordinarily conservative state. It's also home to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, also known as the Mormon Church, which is very active with WCF. In fact, one of their high-ranking leaders in their 12 Apostles, Dallin H. Oakes, actually sits on the board of the Howard Center, which is the umbrella group for WCF. I think that they are trying to get as much friendly press as possible so that in the future, as they continue their work overseas and groups like PRA and others try and talk about it, U.S. press says, oh, no, we met them. They don't do stuff like that. They told us so.
Well, I know that you're in Salt Lake City, and you're there so you can watch what's going on and hear what's being said. Could you mention a few of the speakers at this year's World Congress of Families, and let's see if we know any of these people?
I'd be happy to. One is Sharon Slater, who is part of Family Watch International. Other speakers, as far as politicians who are speaking, we're actually seeing Ted Cruz's father, Rafael Cruz, is going to be there. One person of particular note to watch is actually Reverend Samuel Rodriguez, who has built up a big name for himself in the United States as a quote-unquote moderate voice, who is bringing the evangelical Hispanic community together. And yet when he goes overseas, he's advocating for these same types of principles that we're seeing. It's one of those, you know, the moderate who isn't.
Yes. Would you take a minute or two and tell us about the Political Research Associates and the work that you do with the Southern Poverty Law Center? I want our listeners to know more about you.
Political Research Associates has been around since 1981. We are not an advocacy organization. We are a research think tank. Mm-hmm. Everything that we produce is geared to expose what different right-wing individuals are up to, whether that is the Christian right, the economic right, mm-hmm. You know, paleo yeah. right. We get into yeah. just about everything. But our goal is to help activists, advocacy organizations, and really all people of conscience to understand what the right is doing and how thoroughly well-connected, coordinated, and efficient they are at what they do. You know, we have a big concern that since the Ronald Reagan era, there has been this perception on the left that the right is, you know, a bunch of hillbilly rednecks who, mm-hmm. you know, these are idiots who don't know what they're talking about. When in fact that is not the case. The U.S. right in all of its iterations is one of the most efficient machines on the planet. And you can look at in just about any policy area to see that that is happening, whether it's the exportation of the culture wars, their anti-LGBTQ and anti-reproductive health and freedom here in the United States, the decline of labor and rights for workers. It truly is amazing to watch. And we are of the belief that the more people know about this, the more efficiently we are going to be able to start combating that. But until we overcome that perception of the right being dumb, it won't happen.
Eric Ethington is Communications Director at Political Research Associates. As the World Congress of Families, one of the leading organizations leveraging religion to promote global homophobia, meets this weekend in Salt Lake City, we're fortunate to have PRA on this case and helping shine a spotlight on their destructive agenda. Eric, thanks so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Just a week ago, Salt Lake City was host to a very different kind of gathering, the Parliament of the World's Religions. Interfaith Alliance of Long Island's Mark Lukens was there, and we'll get his firsthand report later in the hour. Religion News Service has been around a long time, longer than this show. In fact, RNS was founded way back in 1934. In an age when a religious component is present in so many events around the world, it's more important than ever to have a religion news source that is resolutely secular, objective, and non-sectarian. RNS Newswire reports are featured in publications that in total have a circulation well over 100 million. No pressure. Since the start of this show, RNS has been a vital resource for us. Former editor-in-chief Kevin Ekstrom was always generous with his time and brought insights that I think many of us would not have had access to otherwise. In all honesty, the question of who would be next to take on this role was a significant one for us. That's why the appointment of veteran journalist and broadcaster Jerome Sokolowski as editor-in-chief of Religion News Service came as welcome news indeed. An award-winning religion correspondent for Voice of America Radio, who's also worked for NPR and the Associated Press, Jerome, congratulations on this important position and welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much, Welton. It's good to be here.
You've been at this a long time, and you've been based in some of the world's hotspots over the years.
I've been in some of the hotspots in the Middle East, in Israel, in Cyprus. I've done quite a bit of reporting from Arab countries, from Syria, Egypt, Yemen, and Jordan mainly. I've also been in some of the nicer places of the world, in the Netherlands and in Spain, too. Obviously, I have come across religion in different forms in those different places.
Right. What originally drew you to religion and journalism?
I guess it depends how far back you want to go. I mean, I came at this whole thing with a clean slate. I had no idea that I even wanted to be a journalist when I was growing up, and even I went to college and studied engineering. But afterward, I started getting interested in writing, and I figured if I'm going to learn to write, I might as well be a journalist.
Uh-huh.
So I got lucky and got freelance jobs, and then finally started working full-time for the Associated Press, later filing for NPR, and then VOA, Voice of America. As I went along reporting, I saw that religion was often kind of the unspoken element of many stories, or the glossed over or the lightly touched upon element. And I have a faith background. I grew up Jewish in, you know, the suburbs of Philadelphia, kind of moderately Jewish with, you know, my family did care very much. We went to synagogue. And so, you know, I saw what it was, you know, that for people who do care deeply about their faith, sometimes the way stories are reported is unsatisfactory.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like, well, there's a whole element here that's really being underreported.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen coverage of religion change over the years? I have to tell you, I have seen it dramatically change. When I went to Interfaith Alliance, we tried to get stories on the air that about religion that nobody cared about at that time. And so we've seen a dramatic change from that until now everybody's doing some kind of religion.
I agree with you. And I guess sadly or tragically, I think 9/11 had a lot to do with that in forcing us to realize that, you know, certainly extreme kinds of religion do need to be reported on and mm-hmm. talked about. But you're right, in a general sense, you know, going back to the 70s and 80s, gradually there's been more attention paid to this, and I think the religion reporting has gotten better. And ironically, now is a time when it's definitely needed, the value of it is recognized, and yet we're at a time when newspapers are shutting down, or, mm-hmm. or if they're still in business, they're letting go of what they see as the less crucial reporters, and sometimes that's the religion reporter
right.
That they let go of. And I see a lot of reporters who sincerely try to cover religion. I just think that they don't often have the religious literacy mm-hmm. That they need. Certainly in this country, you know, some people do know about their own faiths, if they are people of faith, but they don't have a background really in comparative religion. We don't do a very good job of educating people mm-hmm. about religion in America, and I count myself there as well. I don't remember learning much or if anything about religion in public school as a kid. So reporters come at this with, maybe they know some economics if they're covering economic stories, maybe they have some political science if they're doing political stories, but when it comes to religion stories, often they approach it either as an outsider or with limited knowledge.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of the coverage of the religious aspects of the presidential races so far this year?
I think there's been some good reporting, actually, that I've seen, perhaps not as widely reported as it should be, of Donald Trump and mm-hmm. kind of his complicated views about religion, yet popularity with conservative evangelicals and the disconnect there. I've seen a certain amount of reporting on other candidates. I would like to see more. I'd like to see, you know, Bernie Sanders. How does his Jewish background affect his views? There was a good piece in The New Yorker about it. And partly this is the candidate's own not wanting to talk about it, not wanting to bring it up. And I'd like to see a little more delving into Ben Carson and, you know, what did he really mean when he said he would not want a Muslim president? You know, some people reflexively said, oh, this is a violation of our Constitution, but maybe he was expressing a personal preference, and if you dig a little deeper, maybe there's something more to it.
Yeah. RNS does some of its best work in doing reporting that is more objective and gives more context to the story, which we seldom get in a lot of the so-called news that is more commentary than news.
Well, that's great to hear, Welton, and I take absolutely no credit for that because I'm not even on the job yet. I start next month in November. I mean, one of the reasons that I was attracted to this organization is I really like the reporting they do. They have incredibly talented people. And I believe that today there are huge discussions about what can journalists contribute in this day and age of everything, of instantly available online and you know, citizen journalists and, you know, all the tweeting and social media. And I think really a journalist now has to bring some kind of added value to his or her story. And I think that's something that RNS really does have. And I want to, you know, push them further when I take the helm in saying, okay, you have this expertise. Let's get some more context in there. Let's cover this in a way that the New York Times can't, or the Washington Post, or even the BBC. Let's get some more depth into the religious dimension of this story.
You've done a lot of coverage of how people in foreign countries view the role of religion in American culture and politics. Would you talk about those perceptions that exist now? Because I think it's something that many of us in the United States really don't understand.
Mainly that I've had to keep in mind what are the views that people overseas have of religion in America.
Right.
As a VOA religion reporter, I was doing some stories from overseas. That's true. But mainly, my mission was to explain religion in America to overseas audiences, and, mm-hmm. and not just religion, religiosity, spirituality, how we live out our beliefs in this country.
Yeah.
And I guess, by and large, these are gross generalizations, but I would, in the places I've been, which is mainly Europe and the Middle East, Europeans, and especially secular Europeans, have this sense that America is this crazy place where we, you know, we're all snake handlers and speaking in tongues and mm-hmm. just irrationally believing in things like God. Wow.
Yeah.
And then in the Middle East, it's a kind of on the other side of the coin. I think many people in the Middle East, especially Muslims, understand that America is a place of faith. And many of them really do admire this idea that we're very pluralistic. Most of us are very tolerant of each other, tolerant to the point where we don't mind, or we don't at least openly object when people of our own faith convert to another faith, which is something that they do have trouble with, at least the authorities there do.
Yeah. I'm curious, is there a favorite story that you got to cover during your long career in religion journalism? And if so, what is it?
Wow. I guess one of the eye-opening moments, let's say, for me was mm-hmm. Back in the 90s, covering a gathering of Christians in Jerusalem for the Feast of Tabernacles, and seeing just, you know, the huge production that was put on by Christians who'd come from all over the place. That's when, to me, that link between Christians and the Holy Land really, really came home for me. There was another story I did back in, I guess it was around 2003 or 2004 or so, in the midst of post 9/11, around the time of the invasion of Iraq, interviewing Muslim immigrants in southern Spain, in Granada and Cordoba, and talking to them about what does the Andalusian concept, this idea of southern Spain back in the medieval times, was called Andalusia, and it was a Muslim kingdom or a succession of Muslim kingdoms. And for many Muslims, that represented a real golden age of their faith. And even some Al-Qaeda leaders had talked about, you know, let's reconquer southern Spain. And so it was interesting to talk to Muslims who were living there, immigrants from Morocco or Spanish converts, about what that land really meant to them. And then I guess I would also mention a story I did here in Texas on a Nigerian church, the Reformed Christian Church of God, which is building a huge complex down outside of Dallas and has very, very ambitious plans for expanding in our own country. That was a story kind of on what's called the reverse mission, this idea of Christians from the third world coming and proselytizing here in America and in Europe as well.
What are the biggest challenges you see that you face right now going into this job?
Well, the biggest challenge is just having a handful of full-time reporters covering a topic this huge. You know, every day there are dozens of stories that we can do, and we'll have to make a selection. Right now, I'm just daunted by that idea of we're going to have to let so many things go, mm-hmm. perhaps, hopefully, for a later date. That's probably the biggest challenge. And then I've seen a lot of statistics, surveys about the rise of the nuns, the N-O-N-E-S,
right.
the people
right.
who are either atheist or agnostic or spiritual but not mm-hmm. religious. And I want to be fair to them and tell their story or stories. And that's kind of hard when you don't have an organized institution to go to. You do have some atheist and humanistic organizations, but you don't really have like denominational structures that you can find to get a sort of an overview. So it's a much harder group of people to get a hold of and to report about in a very representative way.
Jerome Sokolowski is a veteran religion journalist and broadcaster who starts as editor-in-chief at Religion News Service next month. RNS is an essential resource for anyone concerned with religion's role in our culture, our government, and our world. And in addition to finding the work of their journalist in many leading publications, you can, and you should, visit religionnews.com on a regular basis. Jerome, I hope this is the beginning of a conversation that extends a long time between the two of us. I can't thank you enough for taking the time to be with us today before you're even on the job. And I want to wish you much success in your new position and to warn you that we will be calling you on many occasions, and I hope that's okay.
That's definitely okay. I'd like to say any time, but certainly lots of times whenever I can take a break from reporting and editing. And I'd like to thank you, Welton, for the good work that you do on this show.
Thank you.
And encourage listeners to visit us, as you said, at religionnews.com. We are a nonprofit organization. Most of it is privately funded. So if you like what we do, I would encourage you to consider supporting us. And, Welton, it was
yes.
great to talk to you.
Same here. It's an interesting coincidence that Salt Lake City, Utah, the global home of the Mormon faith, has played host for two very different global gatherings in the span of only 2 weeks. As we discussed earlier in the show, the frightening World Congress of Families descended on the city this weekend. But last weekend, it was a very different scene as 10,000 representatives of 50 faith traditions traveled from 80 countries to the Parliament of the World's Religions in Salt Lake City. Among those taking part was the Reverend Mark Lukens, a pastor in the United Church of Christ and chairperson of the Board of Directors at Interfaith Alliance of Long Island. He's been on this show before. I'm happy to have him return to the show. Mark, welcome back to State of Belief.
Thank you. Thank you, Weldon. It's wonderful to be here.
For listeners who may not have heard of the Parliament of the World's Religions, would you start with just a brief summary of what it is and just a quick history?
Beginning in the 1890s, I believe, 1893, I think, in Chicago, It is a gathering every few years of people of all different faiths from all over the world. People who get together to teach each other, to learn from each other about their faith, about their beliefs, but most importantly, to find ways that we can work together to make the world a better place for all of its people. And so we gather every 5 years or so and have a few days together and workshops on different things, different themes. This year, our theme was climate change, addressing climate change. And we talk about the important things that affect us all, religio-political extremism around the world, faith communities in crisis, hunger, poverty, and what are faithful responses to those kinds of problems.
Mm-hmm. Why was it important for you to take this time off to go to the Parliament of the World's Religions?
I think that today, more than ever, we are facing crises that are affecting all the people of the world. Climate change, of course, affects everyone. And I think that it's absolutely imperative as a Christian, as an American, as a human being, that I do what little I can to promote peace and understanding between the different faiths. That's an imperative of my faith. And specifically, I was asked to be part of a panel discussing intra-religious responses to extremism. And extremism is a threat that is nearly as global and as dangerous as climate change, or even perhaps equally so.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is something that I feel very strongly about. It's part of our mission as a chapter at the Interfaith Alliance and, of course, the Interfaith Alliance nationally.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt like I needed to be there. I had an opportunity, and you know, I'm a preacher, so somebody mm-hmm. offered me a pulpit.
Well, I'm curious as to what you said, and also curious as to whether or not the other people on the panel were pretty much talking about the same thing you were, or were there some contradictions to that?
There were four of us on the panel with a moderator, a rabbi, Rabbi Ray Abulia,
mm-hmm.
Dr. Sheikh Ubaid, a Muslim scholar, Kanan Srinivasan, a Hindu journalist and writer and teacher at Columbia,
mm-hmm.
and each of us spoke from our own tradition
mm-hmm.
about the extremism in our own tradition in the United States and other parts of the world, and what we thought that where that came from and what we could do about it. And so I spoke about Christian extremism and then what we can do about it. You know, I think that Christian extremism now comes from a sense of angst
mm-hmm.
and despair about modernism, about multiculturalism, about the things that people see as threatening their privileged place in the world or a place that they believe should be privileged.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that was interesting about the presentation, our Hindu scholar focused primarily on the Hindutva extremist movement in India. Of course, our Muslim presenter focused on Islamic extremism, and our Jewish presenter on the settler movement and Jewish extremism. And one, the thing is that is the most striking is how similar all these movements are, not only in terms of their basic beliefs,
mm-hmm.
but in their own kind of response, groups responding to the idea that their cultural domination is somehow threatened in the societies that they are in.
Hmm.
And it was a very, what was striking to me was less what was different, but more what we had in common.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Well, what were the highlights of the gathering that had particular impact on you?
Well, I think one of the highlights for me was the Sikh langar. Each day for lunch, the Sikhs that were present fed all comers.
Mm-hmm.
A langar is a meal, a ceremonial meal. So we were all invited to come in. Everybody sits on the floor so that we are all equal. And then we are all served and have this tremendous lunch. And all of a sudden, we're all sitting on the floor talking and chatting, being served by these young men and women. And it was just, I thought, besides the fact that the lunch was delicious,
mm-hmm.
it was a great metaphor for, you know, what we're trying to achieve. Because we see just thousands of people all together, all sharing the bread of life, so
mm-hmm.
to speak. It was very moving. There were all kinds of wonderful presentations, speakers on all manner of topics, but I think to me that was probably the highlight.
Did you have opportunities to sit and talk with people that ordinarily you wouldn't have a chance to sit and talk with? Was there a personal dimension to it?
Absolutely. They were great lounge spaces that were provided precisely, I assume, for that reason. So my wife went with me, and she was absolutely moved by the experience. But we would be strolling through, and we would just see somebody sitting, so we would start to chat. There was one conversation that very much moved her with a Native American man who talked about having been taken from his family as a child and sent to a religious boarding school, having his head shaved, which in his tradition was a terrible thing to do, and running away and being dragged back over and over again. And this right here in the United States, these are things that, you know, we don't always hear about.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Mark, you introduced yourself and identified yourself as a preacher, and I know one of the tendencies of preachers, because I am one too, is to be a way to discover something, to hear something, and to feel I just can't wait to get back to the people with whom I share my life and tell them about this. Was there that kind of moment for you, and what did it entail?
I think the moment for me was when I was listening to the other speakers in the panel and recognizing that this struggle that we are engaged in, that the Interfaith Alliance is engaged in against religious extremism, is a struggle for the very soul of our faith. And so how important it is for me to go back to my faith community and really try to illustrate, get across to them the idea that that is what's really on the line, that our reaching out, that our ability, you know, Jesus said, why do you criticize the mote in your neighbor's eye, look to the plank in your own eye, that how essential that is to our faith, to really be intentional and self-critical and look at how we acquiesce or even promote messages of intolerance, how easy it is for our agendas to get confused and to mistake our intention to transform the world as in Christ's image into something that is really about making the world in our own image. So I felt renewed, and I felt that, you know, it was brought home to me again how important this work that we do is. And you know, not just for the sake of democracy or tolerance, right, which are all good things, but for the very heart and soul of our faith. For me as a Christian, for someone else, maybe something else. But that is, you know, there's nothing more important. So that's what I want to bring home. And the ways, you know, we discussed that we can do that. I think one of the most important things that we can do, and I think this is what drew me to the Interfaith Alliance, is we need to stand up, be visible, and be counted. Christians need to be the first ones to condemn extremism in our name, and we need to always be recognizing the links. Christian extremism in the United States, I think, is at its most dangerous, not when we have armed militias or things like that, as bad as those are, but in its acceptance in the mainstream. That's where it's really dangerous. When we have a presidential candidate who says a Muslim cannot be the president. And those are the links that we need to make for our congregations and our people. Not for political reasons, but for the soul of our faith. That's not what it's all about. And that's a betrayal.
The Reverend Mark Lukens is board chair at Interfaith Alliance of Long Island. He's a pastor ordained in the United Church of Christ, and he was one of 10,000 diverse leaders and activists who gathered last weekend in Salt Lake City for the Parliament of the World's Religions. Mark, thanks for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure and an honor.
Before we go, I want to share a few thoughts with you about last week's meeting of the Parliament of the World's Religions. I have supported the work of the Parliament of World's Religions even when I was not able to go to its meetings in various parts of the globe. However, the truth is that some people have become somewhat disenchanted with this gathering. The gathering in Salt Lake City attracted 10,000 people. Former devotees of the parliament complained that it's grown too large for personal interactions among its participants, and it has become more of a show than a time of meaningful interaction. Be that as it may, I have talked with no one who was in Salt Lake City that didn't speak positively about the gathering. Personally, I'm delighted that 10,000 people around the globe were interested in meeting with each other to talk about religious issues. I find great hope in the praise that was evoked by diverse people discovering their commonality in wanting to address together issues that can make the world a better place. Again, this year, six served a meal every day for thousands of people in Salt Lake City to demonstrate their own hospitality toward other religions and the possibility of commonality among all people who get hungry. I see the Parliament of World Religions meeting much like I see the United Nations. There's a lot of public talking and some drama that merits the criticism of not generating much change. However, I know that the most meaningful and important moments of such mass gatherings are not in the highly public venues, but in the innumerable private, very personal conversations that people have with each other as they build bridges across which they can move back and forth for ongoing interaction. Our world is far too fragmented, fragile, and desperate for cooperation for anybody to be too critical of any meeting that brings people together to nurture communion and to explore a common vision. Thanks to the Parliament of World Religions for doing what it can and maybe inspiring some of us to do all we can to make religion play a positive role in our world. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. For almost 10 years now, State of Belief Radio has been bringing stories and voices that you're not going to hear anywhere else to listeners across the country. You know, a question we get asked a lot is, it's 2015, why radio when we've got the internet? And I have to tell you, one thing we've seen as the internet has matured is most people spending their time reading and listening and watching other people they already agree with. In many instances, and this has been disappointing, the result is just a reinforcement of existing opinions and prejudices, a narrowing of worldviews instead of opening them up. One of the things about radio is you're in every home and in every car. People can find you totally by accident, and I hear from those people all the time. We want to keep bringing this show to our regular listeners, and the online resources are there on Facebook, Twitter, and at stateofbelief.com to keep growing an online community. But we don't want to miss out on reaching new listeners who would never think to look for us. If you hear a story that you think is compelling, please be sure to share it with your friends. And as we get closer to the end of the year, I really urge you to consider making a tax-deductible donation to help State of Belief keep its voice on the air. Please visit stateofbelief.com for more information on how you can help. That's stateofbelief.com. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, Welton.